glad to see you tonight. Clearly, I am not Jen. She is not with us tonight because she has the opportunity to be down at a ministry called Breakaway at Texas A&M. And every once in a while, yes, Aggies, whoop it up. Every once in a while, they will do an all-female Breakaway. Breakaway is a Bible study that meets on Tuesday evenings. And last year and this year, Jen has had the privilege to return to the motherland, Aggieland, and teach thousands of college women, and that's where she is tonight. This is the only time that she will not be here with you as a part of this study, and she, I know, her heart is here and wishes that she could be in two places at one time. So in her stead, I am here with you. My name is Ann Lincoln Hollibaugh, and I know many of you in this room. Jen and I are dear friends, and we have taught together in different venues before, and so she has honored me with the opportunity to come and be with you here tonight as we look at such a hard passage of scripture, okay? So a little bit, I feel like, Jen, you went to A&M so you can leave me with all the heavy lifting, but it is going to be great. The Lord has beautiful things, treasures for us in his word tonight. And I don't know about you, if you've been in this text this week, I've been with it for a few weeks, and I'm tired. It's hard work. It's been hard work this week for you, I'm sure, as you've walked through your homework, and it feels a little bit to me like we're climbing up a hill. It has felt like an uphill climb throughout the course of study, and that's not a bad thing. And so we're going to continue to ascend this hill, and here's the good news. This is going to be difficult labor, but it's worthwhile because when we get to the top, when we get to chapter 24, verse 18, we are going to be able to look around, and the view is going to be gorgeous, but we don't get the view unless we go up the hill. And so that's what we're going to do tonight. Before we jump in to the text, a few things that I want to remind you of as we're coming to this passage. We've just heard 2 weeks on the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words, these general requirements of the law, these good commands that the Lord has given his people. And now we're going to walk into the Book of the Covenant, and these are more specific requirements of the law. This is how the Ten Commandments get fleshed out, as it were. And remember, these Israelites, they have only, before this point, known slavery in Egypt. They've been oppressed. They've been under unjust masters. They've had no rights, no laws for protection or provision. And on their own, they're not going to just figure out how to live righteously or how to form a society where justice prevails, where righteousness and joy reign, and where fruitfulness comes about. They're not going to just figure it out. They have no means by which to do that. And the Lord, in his love, doesn't ask them to. He is going to set forward laws and regulations and provisions that teach them how to live under these banners that we talked about the past 2 weeks, under these banners of honor for one another, under the banners of love for God first, and then love for our neighbor as ourselves, or for their neighbor as themselves. And under these banners, we're going to have a society in which we can function with a set of shared values. And so I want you to feel how much the Lord loves these Israelites, and the same love that he has for these Israelites, he has for you and me in Christ. And so his heart is all over these pages, full of oxen and donkey and slaves and all kinds of stuff. So as we go forward, be looking for the heart of God in the midst of this. Two other things to keep in mind. This is not an exhaustive treatment of the laws. It's a representative kind of sample of the laws of the land, and they were intended, this Book of the Covenant, to be in the hands of judges as they were settling disputes for the people. So that's going to be a helpful lens for us as we walk through these chapters. So we're going to start in Exodus 20, 22. And three things I want you to be paying attention to as we walk through this text. We're going to circle around and talk about them at the end as well. But there are at least three themes in the Book of the Covenant that I want you to have your ears open to, where you're going to hear some repetition. They are the purity of the worship of the one true God. The purity of their worship is going to be addressed a number of times. The worship of the one true God. The value and dignity of human life, The Lord's going to talk about that a lot, and the rhythm of Sabbath. So as we walk forward, I want you to be listening for those three things, things that fit into those categories. So here we go, verse 22. And the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone. For if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness be not exposed on it." So the first thing right out of the gate that the Lord is going to address is this idea of the purity of their worship and how they are to worship the Lord as the one true God, that they are not to have any gods of gold, any gods of silver to accompany him, because everything else is false. He is the one true God. And this instruction about stone is important. So he says, if you're going to build an altar of stone on which to sacrifice and worship me, it does not need to be hewn stone, because hewn stone was what they used to build pagan altars. And additionally, this instruction about do not go up to my altar by steps, we've talked about this before. This is the idea that in pagan rituals and in pagan altars, there were stairs present to represent kind of this stairway to heaven, this idea that we can somehow reach God. And we've talked about before that in pagan rituals, they would often perform sex acts on these stairs. And so what the Lord is saying is, your worship is not to in any way come close to resembling that of pagan worship. It looks different. It is to be pure. He is their God. He is the only true God, and they are to worship him in purity. He will not give his glory to another. So let's jump into chapter 21. Now, these are the rules that you are to set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and then in the seventh year, he shall go free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, "I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free," then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall be his slave forever. So this instruction is on slavery, but there are some particular things we need to know about this form of slavery. This is talking about indentured servitude. It would be a voluntary selling of yourself into the service of another to become their slave in order to pay off a debt or to avoid kind of desolation, where you are kind of, you have no means, you have nothing left, you have no way to provide for yourself. And so this was a way within the society to avoid kind of this life of desolation. And this is instruction about Hebrews and Hebrews. So within this Israelite society, how are you to treat those who voluntarily need to sell themselves into slavery? In an agricultural society, it wasn't uncommon for people to fall into economic ruin. And this practice was very common throughout all of the Near East in this day. In fact, the Egyptians even employed this practice. If you'll think back to Genesis, in the time of the famine under Joseph, the land is bearing no food. They are in anguish, but the Lord has appointed Joseph, and right for the 7 years, he stored away the grain so that in the 7 years of famine, there would be provisions for the people to come and buy. Well, the Egyptians are coming to Joseph, and they buy grain and buy grain and buy grain, but eventually they run out of money. And they say, "What do we do?" And he says, "Sell your livestock to me." So they do that. And then they are out of money again. And eventually they say, "Buy us and our land, that we might live and not die." And so the Egyptians themselves sell themselves to Pharaoh in order to have provisions of food. So this practice was very common as a means within the society of living. Now, what's important to notice here is that the dignity of the slave is upheld in a way in these laws given by the Lord that isn't true of other law codes of this day and time. The treatment is much more humane. They are not the complete and permanent slave of their master. They are to serve 6 years, and that was determined to be sufficient to satisfy whatever debt. And then in the seventh year, they are to go free. They maintain their position as a member of society, as fellow Hebrews. And notice the Sabbath rhythm. They're following the rhythm of creation. 6 years, and then in the seventh, you go free. We're going to continue to see that pattern. Verse 7. This might have been a part of the text that caused you a little bit of trouble. Maybe you were finding yourself feeling a little cranky, a little bit confused, but there's good news in here. We're going to find it together. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male servants do. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for a son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So kind of at the beginning, you're thinking, what is going on with these fathers selling their daughters into slavery? This does not sound like a good situation that is happening. But this was a practice employed by families who did not have the means to buy a proper marriage for their daughter. So it wasn't uncommon for a daughter to be sold as a sort of second wife or a slave wife. We see this practice in the course of Old Testament books, the wives of Jacob, for example. He has wives that are kind of secondary slave wives. And it would be this kind of situation where a father sells his daughter into a situation where she can have protection and provision if he's unable to present a dowry and negotiate a proper marriage. It might also be a situation where there's a debt that a family needs to satisfy, and so this is the means by which they do that. It's also important to note that a woman could sell herself into this kind of slavery or servitude, or a father might put his son in the same position in order to satisfy a debt of the family, but there are specific provisions and protection made for women in this situation. This is good news for women. So when we understand these instructions within their culture, this time, this day, this age, they start to make a lot more sense. Other law codes of this day did not make such generous provisions for women. So let's look at some of the ways that women are protected in this situation. They were not turned out as male slaves were. So we just talked about 6 years satisfies a debt and then they are to go free. But this guaranteed a woman a permanent place within the household. And she likely would have had a place within as a worker in the home and not turned out into fields where she might be abused or taken advantage of. She can't be sold to a foreigner. This is significant because what that would do is put her beyond the reach of these laws and statutes that govern the way that Hebrews are to deal with other Hebrews. So she can't be sent off to some foreign people who don't deal with women in the way that the Lord does, and where she would be beyond his covering and protection. This master, this husband, is not able to do that. If she is to become a wife to his son, she is to be treated just as his very own daughter. And if he takes another wife, the care he has for this wife, this slave wife in a sense, cannot be diminished or changed, or she is able to go free. So this was good news. These were generous provisions made. It is important to note with this last idea that if he takes another wife, There's a polygamy going on, you know, here in this day and age and in this society. And while the Lord isn't condoning it here in this passage, he's acknowledging that it's a part of life, and he is giving instruction and making provision such that people will be less harmed by it. Now, in your homework, there's an interesting question put before you related to if you could rewrite this section of the Book of the Covenant, how would you do it? What would you put instead? And ask you to consider why it is that the Lord doesn't overturn things that to us seem confusing, outdated, reprehensible even. And it's important to note that the Lord does not come in and overturn the current existing socioeconomic way things are, but instead he gives his people instructions and laws to live by such that they might be a righteous people in the midst of this kind of crooked generation, this broken world, because they are his treasured possession. And we see Jesus do the exact same thing centuries later. When Jesus comes on the scene, he does not lead a military revolt to overturn Roman occupation. That's what they expect Messiah to do, but that's not what he does at all. Instead, he tells his followers that any who would come after him and be a follower of Jesus, he teaches them how to be light and how to be salt in the midst of a lost and dying world, rendering under Caesar what is Caesar's and submitting righteously and faithfully unto authority. So we need to pay attention to this because we live in a current day and time and culture where there are things within our world and the law of the land does not always reflect what the scriptures teach about truth and justice and righteousness. And sometimes we feel confused and we want that to be different. We want the Lord to make it different. But in his sovereignty and in his wisdom, he allows the inconsistency. And he puts before us ways to live as those who would be, as Paul instructed the Philippians in Philippians 2, he tells them, you are to be lights that shine in the midst of a twisted and crooked generation. And we see that happening here in the Book of the Covenant as well. Let's continue on in verse 12. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. And if he did not lay in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him away from my altar that he may die. Whoever strikes his father or mother shall be put to death. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him, shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. So we see four provisions here, four instructions, four laws that all end the same way. They all end in death, kind of this zero tolerance policy for the taking of life, for abuse of the elderly. If you'll remember, when we talked about the command to honor your mother and father that it might go well with you, the audience was that of adults. And so the same is going to be true here. For your mother and your father, your aged parent, if anyone even raised a hand to strike them, it ended in death. Whoever steals a man and sells him, this is human trafficking. This is stealing someone and taking away their right and selling them as a possession. And the Lord says, I will have none of it. And whoever curses his father or mother, this is the idea of treating with contempt. And we see again how significant it is that within the household, within the community, within the society, within the household, that there is to be honor and respect. It becomes this core building block of society as a whole. Verse 18, when men quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with a fist, and the man does not die but takes to his bed, then if the man rises again and walks outdoors with a staff, he who struck him shall be clear. Only he shall pay for the loss of time and shall have him thoroughly healed. So two men get in a fight, one gets beat up, he doesn't die, but if he's able to recover and walk on his staff, then the one who beat him up needs to pay for his medical expenses and his lost time and needs to make sure he's restored to health. When a man strikes a slave, male or female, with a rod and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. And here we see this instruction as intended to prevent excessive abuse by masters. And throughout the course of this, and as we're going to continue on, we are seeing how significant life is to the Lord. The value and the dignity of human life, regardless of place in society, regardless of gender, it matters. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now, this situation on the front end, I don't know if it struck you as kind of this, I don't understand what's happening here. I'm not sure. Is this really common? You've got two guys, and they end up kind of getting in a fight, and they're, like, striking each other, but they run into this pregnant lady. Like, how prevalent was this? I'm not sure, but it was important enough, you know, for the Lord to make instruction specifically about this situation. But there's some important things to see here. We see that the Lord is making provision for those yet to be born. He's speaking here to the right and to the protection of the unborn. It's a situation that causes either premature labor or miscarriage. And so he's saying this life is valuable. And then we also see in verse 24, just a little bit before it, some phrasing that might sound familiar. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And this is a legal principle that's introduced here called lex talionis. And it kind of was this idea that true justice looks like inflicting the same injury on the culprit that they inflicted on the victim. And what it's meant to be in the hands of judges is a way to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. It was actually a protection from excessive punishment. So whatever the infliction was, you needed to be punished to that degree, but not any more severely. So this idea that the punishment should fit the crime. And it was intended to be used by judges, right, to settle disputes among the people. It was not intended to be used in everyday kind of life-on-life relationships, whereby I take justice into my own hands if you offend me and I decide what retribution needs to look like. That's not how this principle was intended to be used. But we're going to see in the New Testament, in the Gospels, that this misuse was exactly what was taking place. And we see Jesus correct that in Matthew 5. So if this idea of you have heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, if that sounded familiar to you as you were reading through that, it's because Jesus is referring to this exact principle and he is correcting what's going on where people are kind of playing judge and jury for themselves in the course of everyday relationships. And he turns it on his head. So what he's going to say in Matthew chapter 5 is instead of returning slap for slap, you turn the other cheek and you go the extra mile and you give an extra tunic and you meet people more than halfway and you extend generosity and mercy that isn't asked for, isn't earned, isn't deserved. So he's actually going to turn this principle on its head in relation to the way that we bear with one another. Verse 26, when a man strikes the eye of the slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his truth. Again, this is provision against excessive abuse, and it's also communicating how significant it is to preserve a person's ability to work in order to be included in the fabric of society, but even outside of this kind of slave context, to be able to support themselves and maintain livelihood. So their ability to have quality of life matters. The Lord's communicating about that. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned, but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall be put to death. If a ransom is imposed on him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is imposed on him. If it gores a man's son or daughter, then he shall be dealt with according to the same rule. The ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And what's being communicated here is that no loss of human life goes unpunished. And this is true regardless of social standing or gender. Men and women are valued equally under these laws, and that is significant. This next section is going to deal about laws related to restitution, and it's going to be dealing with property, and in this context, property looks like animals. And so as you were walking through your homework and reading this week, you may have felt like my head is spinning with all of the oxen and donkeys and I can't keep up with this situation and this situation. So let's look at it together. We're going to kind of fly through some chunks of this. When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restoration. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his. When a man's ox butts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price, and the dead beast also they shall share. Or if it is known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his. Now it's important here, we've kind of heard twice, if a man knows that his ox is bad and he doesn't take care to keep that ox locked up and he goes and kills a person or butts another ox or whatever, then that owner is held responsible. This is related to negligence. This guy's just careless. He knows his ox is bad news. He's not keeping his ox locked up. And when there's injury caused by his carelessness, restitution is owed even to the point of his life. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun is risen on him, then there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for a theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it is an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall pay double. So in the case of thievery, if someone steals, they need to pay back more than what they took. And this idea of, you may have been confused by, okay, if he breaks in and he dies, no blood guilt. But if the sun's risen on him, then there shall be blood guilt. What this is about is if someone breaks in the middle of the night, you can't see, you don't have your wits about you. And if he ends up dead because you're defending yourself, that's considered okay. But if it's in the daylight, the sun has risen, and you have your senses about you and you can avoid his death and you don't, then you're going to need to answer for that situation. That's what's happening there. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed over, or lets his beast loose and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and in his vineyard. And if fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that the sacked grain or the standing grain or the field is consumed, he who started the fire shall make full restitution. Now, this part where there's all this carelessness going on and accidental, I think this is significant because this idea of restitution is, you have suffered an injury at my hand, whether willfully or unwillfully, and it's appropriate for me to make it right. So that's what it's saying here. Where there's injury that you've suffered by my hand, it's my responsibility to make it right from the best of my field, to replenish what has been taken from you. Now, if a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe, and it's stolen from the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for an ox, for a donkey, for a sheep, for a cloak, for any kind of lost thing of which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before God. The one whom God condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. So here's the situation. I ask you to watch my stuff. It goes missing. there's a thief maybe on the loose, but if he's not caught and brought to justice, then it's possible that maybe while my stuff was in your keeping, you just decided to pocket it. And so we're going to go together before the Lord and let the Lord determine whether or not you put your hand to my stuff. And if he determines you didn't, we're good. But if he determines that you did, you pay me back double. Now, if a man gives to his neighbor a donkey or an ox or sheep or any beast to keep safe, and it dies or is injured or is driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them both to see whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. The owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what is torn. So I very naturally ask you to watch my donkey. And while you're watching my donkey, if it dies or it gets injured or it's driven away by some crazy kind of animal, but there's no evidence that that's actually what happened, we will once again go to the Lord, go before the Lord. And if you make an oath before the Lord that you did nothing wrong, then I will, on faith, accept that. And my donkey is just dead, or is just hurt, or is just gone. But if I ask you to watch my donkey and it gets stolen while it's in your care, you need to give me a new donkey. And if I ask you to watch my donkey and it gets eaten by wild animals and you bring to me the dead body, we're good to go. You don't have to give me a new donkey. If a man borrows anything of his neighbor and it gets injured or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for its hiring fee. So if you borrow my donkey and it gets hurt or it dies and I'm not there, you give me a new donkey. Now, in all of the talk about donkeys and oxen and all of this, here is something that's so beautiful and important and lost on us in this passage. This is about making a wrong right. And I think that this is significant because in our day and age, in evangelicalism and under the covering of grace, we have lost this understanding of maybe a misunderstanding of forgiveness and a misunderstanding of grace. But if you suffer harm at my hand, I need to do something to make it right. If I borrow your Anthropology sweater, and while I'm wearing it and getting all these compliments, I spill coffee all over it, then it's not enough for me to be sorry. And it's not enough for me to say, I'm so sorry, and hand it back to you ruined. What I need to do is I need to get myself to the dry cleaner. And if it doesn't come out of the dry cleaner, guess what? I need to hand it back to you with my sorry and a gift card to Anthropology, right? I need to make my wrong right to the degree that I can. And so this isn't about serving penance. This isn't about earning forgiveness. Forgiveness is freely given. It's just about making our wrong right to the degree that we can. Let's look at verse 16. If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. So this instruction is a provision against both consensual premarital sex and rape. In this day, the way marriages were arranged, which we alluded to earlier, was it was a contract struck between two families where the groom's family would offer a bride price and the bride's family would offer a dowry. And the bride price for a virgin was considerably higher. So if there is a situation where a man took a woman's virginity from her, he is not only subjecting her to social shame, he's compromising her ability to be married or to have a good marriage, because she would now be considered kind of tainted goods. And her asking price goes down considerably. It just ends her in a really bad situation where she's going to end up in either a bad marriage or unable to marry, which means she is going to either be in servitude or a prostitute or some kind of destitute situation. And so this is meant as a warning against engaging in premarital sex or against men taking advantage of women and taking from them something that is not theirs as their husband. Again, these laws are offering protection for women in a less than ideal situation. Verse 18, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. So these three, sorcery, bestiality, and idolatry, there's not a lot of conversation around these. There's not a lot of elaboration. It's pretty cut and dry. These are bad for the whole of society, bad for the person, and the Lord will not allow them. Now, starting in verse 21, if you'll remember from your homework, we're going to enter into a section of this passage that is called the chiasmus, which is a literary kind of device used to draw our attention to a central theme. That's going to start in verse 21, where the Lord starts communicating kind of laws about social justice and advocating for the rights of the weak and the oppressed. And he says, he's instructing his people, you shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. And a sojourner is a temporary inhabitant lacking inherited rights. It's someone who does not belong to this land. They're dwelling in a land not their own. And he's saying, you shall not oppress these people. You were just like them. Remember that. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. Now, if you lend money to any of my people who is with you that is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. If you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. The Lord's heart and the Lord's ear are bent toward the poor, toward the weak, toward the vulnerable. And so he is telling his people, do not exploit the poor. They are at your mercy. So show them mercy. You shall not revile God nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its mother. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be consecrated to me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. And so here, verse 31, this is the central theme of this chiasmus. This is where our attention needs to be drawn. This idea, you are a people set apart for me, by me. You are mine. And as such, as my consecrated, set apart people, you are to be the way that I am. Kind of this idea of be holy as I am holy. The things that I care about, you care about. As my consecrated, set apart people, you care for the poor and the weak and the vulnerable. You are consecrated to me, by me, for me. And as God's people, we should have the heart that he does for the least of these. And we should act on their behalf just like he would and just like he does. And it's interesting to note that other law codes in the Near East at this time had a sliding scale for justice based on where people fell in the social order and their social status. But that's not true of this community. That's not true of the people of God. Life is valued, all human life, regardless of power, regardless of social status. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many who do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit, siding with the many so as to pervert justice, nor shall you be partial to the poor man in his lawsuit. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him. You shall rescue it with him. So he's drawing their attention back to care for others such that it benefits the whole and extending mercy and grace to the last people you would ever want to extend mercy and grace to. And verses 4 and 5, this idea of you meet your enemy's ox, you're to help it. You meet someone who you know hates you, you are to render aid. Sounds very much like the Good Samaritan, what we talked about last week. This is a man who rendered aid to one who he knew hated him. He was the good neighbor. And the Lord is saying, you be the good neighbor for the good of the whole and the good of the part. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his lawsuit. Keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. You shall not oppress the sojourner. You know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. And he bookends this section with this idea, do not oppress the sojourner. Do not oppress the sojourner. And he says something interesting here. You know the heart of the sojourner. He's appealing to the hearts of his people who just suffered under the oppressive hand of the Egyptians. So what is it that their heart remembers? What is the heart of a sojourner that he wants them to identify with such that they extend mercy? You're dwelling in a land that's not your own, a language and a culture, customs and laws that are all different. Everything is unfamiliar. You are different and probably detested for being so. You're at risk of exploitation and oppression. You have no rights, no protection. You are powerless. You don't belong. Yet here you are. You are weak and you are afraid and you are desperate. And what he's saying to his people is, do not do to others what was just done to you. And the mercy and compassion you wish had been afforded to you, you now afford to those who are weak in your midst. And we too can identify with this heart of the sojourner. We are sojourners. We are exiles. Our citizenship is not here. It's above. It's in heaven. It's in the new Jerusalem, the new heavens, the new earth. This place is not our home. So we can, as sojourners in this land that is not ours, where we do not belong, where it just doesn't feel right, we can have the same kind of compassion on those in our midst that are physically sojourners, foreigners, weak and defenseless. All right, let's move on to verse 10. We're going to boogie through Sabbath and festivals. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and that what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, that the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. So here again, we're going to see this Sabbath rhythm of 6 and 1. And here, the Lord is instructing them towards Sabbath in some pretty drastic ways. And it's important to note that Sabbath is not just good for the part, for the person. It blesses the whole. And it gives provision such that in the long term, there's even greater fruitfulness for the animal, for the land, for the servant. And Sabbath requires a lot of faith. It is a living confession, kind of this active declaration that, Lord, I trust you to work on my behalf. I trust you that it's not all up to me. And this is something that we struggle with. We buy into the temptation and the lie that if we don't, it won't. And observing Sabbath and resting is a declaration, Lord, it is not up to me. I want to be faithful to what you've put before me. But faithfulness looks like sitting still so that I can see you work on my behalf and recognize your provision. Verse 13, pay attention to all that I have said to you and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. Three times in the year you shall keep a feast to me. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. As I commanded you, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days at the appointed time in the month of Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall keep the feast of harvest, of the first fruits of your labor, of what you sow in the field. You shall keep the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in from the field the fruit of your labor. Three times in the year shall all your males appear before the Lord. So here we see the Lord appoint three different festivals, three different feasts that are a celebration of his provision and a sacrifice, saying, we recognize, we give back to you what you have given to us. We recognize that we only have if it's given from your hand. And so they sacrifice first fruits as the harvest begins to come in and as the harvest comes all the way in. And this feast of unleavened bread, this was also the Passover. The Lord appointed this, instituted this back in Exodus chapter 12, the night that the plague of the death of the firstborn swept through Egypt, right? And he told his people, take an unblemished lamb, slaughter it, put the blood on your door, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And so he institutes for them this physical, active time of remembrance, a testimony for them to remember his faithfulness in delivering them out of Egypt. It is during the Passover that Jesus gathers his disciples, breaks bread, pours wine, and puts forward a new feast of remembrance in communion. The significance of remembering what the Lord has done is huge. When we actively remember who he is and what he's done, it increases our confidence in him and his faithfulness. It leads us to obedience, and our obedience leads us to joy. He does not want them to forget that all things come by his hand, that he has been faithful to deliver. Verse 18, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the fat of my feast remain until morning. The best of your first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Again, these are instructions about the purity of their worship. And this idea, this may have seemed weird to you. It did to me. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. This is where kosher eating came from, and this was related to a pagan ritual that was related to kind of increasing or inducing fertility. So again, the Lord is saying, your worship is to look nothing like what you've seen before. It is to be pure before me. Now, as we move into verse 20, we're going to look ahead to where the Lord is taking his people. He says, behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. My name is in him, complete authority given by the Lord. But if you carefully listen to his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemy and an adversary to your adversary. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow before the gods nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water. I will take away sickness from you. None shall miscarry or be barren in the land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites and the Canaanites and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little, I will drive them out before you. What he is telling his people is, I have not only delivered you out of slavery, but I have taken you out of Egypt because we're going to the promised land. This land that I promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, this is where we're going. I'm sending an angel before you to guard you and guide you into this land that will be beautiful and abundant and flow with milk and honey. And he uses some language here to communicate, this place where I'm taking you, this place that I've promised for you, it will be good and blessed and fruitful. And so when he talks about milk and honey and streams flowing with that, there aren't actual streams of milk and actual rivers of honey. It's signifying blessing and abundance. And likewise, when he talks about no sickness, no miscarriage, no more, all of these things, if that caught your attention, it did mine, what he's saying is this is going to be a time of fruitfulness and blessing. And there is coming a day where these words will truly and literally be fulfilled as we walk into the consummation of the kingdom. Notice also the incredible mercy of God. He lets their enemies linger for just a time such that the land will be inhabitable for them. He lets them stay so that it's not taken over by all these crazy animals and they wouldn't be able to live there anyway. It seems counterintuitive that he wouldn't just wipe out all of their enemies at once, but he is wisely making provision for his people. Chapter 24, the summit is coming, girls. We are almost there. We are almost to the top of the hill. Then he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with me." Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they all said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." Yes, bless your heart. You want that. And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." So the people hear the words of God and say, "Yes, we will do that." We say the same thing. "Yes, we will obey." But we know in just a breath, disobedience will be right there. And Moses does something interesting that when I read through this kind of freaked me out. He throws blood on the altar. I can handle that. But then he takes the rest of the blood and he sprinkles it on the people. I think that I don't want that. That feels like strange and kind of gross. But when you think about what's happening here, as this covenant is being confirmed, I want nothing more than to be covered with this blood, because they say we will obey, but we know that disobedience is coming. They will not keep these words, and there will need to be an atoning for their sin. And there is an atoning for sin through blood, because without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And before they know their need, the blood is provided. They are covered. The covenant is confirmed with this shedding of blood. And their blessing from the Lord is contingent upon their obedience. There are all of these if-then provisions. We know this blood that they're covered with, it won't be enough. They're going to continue to sin. Their sin needs to be atoned for. There will be sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice that stands between these people and the cross. There is more blood to be shed for their sin. And this blood, though it seals the covenant, though it is provision, it's just not sufficient. And in your homework, you looked into the blood that is sufficient. You looked at Hebrews 12, where it talks about being sprinkled, Christ sprinkling with his blood. I'm going to read this just quickly as we're nearing the end. This is out of Hebrews 12. If we had more time, we would go there together, but I'll just read it for us. He's talked about what happened on Mount Sinai and says, "But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. And just as in Passover, he said, 'When I see the blood, I will pass over.' He sees the blood in the book of the covenant sprinkled on the people and says, I will see the blood and I will pass over. And then he sees the blood of his son shed once for all and says, I see the blood and I will pass over. Jesus has secured for us a new and better and lasting covenant, better than the blood of Abel. So Abel died early in Genesis. He was killed by his brother and his blood cried out for vengeance and said, because this man died, or because this man's blood was shed, you must die. But Christ's blood speaks a better word and says, because this man died, because his blood was shed, you have life. Where Abel's blood screams out for vengeance, the blood of Christ declares forgiveness. And where Abel's blood cries out for atonement, Christ's blood says fully and finally and forever, it is finished. No more sacrifice for sin. The altar is closed. There is no more blood to be shed. This is the best possible news. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. Okay, verse 9. This I didn't even know was in the Bible. I'm going to be honest with you. What happens next, I didn't even know until I was studying for this. Then Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire sown, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. They were face to face with the living God and not consumed. And we see that this confirmation of the covenant leads to communion with God. They ate with God. I didn't even know. This was in Exodus 24. That's incredible. And here we see this communion, this face to face fellowship is for the leaders of Israel, for these priests. And the line of priests out of Aaron through the priesthood is going to flow through them. They are the ones that get to see face to face. But for us as New Testament believers, sealed by the blood of Christ, the royal priesthood, we are invited to this meal in the new heavens and the new earth. We're invited in. Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. The Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him go to them. Then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. And so as we close out tonight, as we leave the Israelites, they are in the care of Aaron and Hur. Moses has gone up onto the mountain to receive more words from the Lord. And next week, we are going to find out what they are. So we have seen the generous and good provision of the Lord, giving his people good and true commandments that lead to righteous living, the good of society, fruitfulness of life. And I want to draw our attention quickly back to those three themes that we talked about at the beginning. Did you notice them? Purity of worship for the one true God, the value and dignity of all human life, and the Sabbath rhythm. And so as we walk out of here tonight, these are the very things that are the heart of God. His commandments reveal his heart. And so these things are at the heart of God for us, his daughters, his people. So let's check in on these three things. How is the purity of our worship toward the one true God? He will not entertain a rival. Are we valuing all human life the way the Lord does? Are we advocating for the weak? Are there some people we value in society over others? Are we complicit in oppression because we do nothing and we fail to pray? And are we living in a Sabbath rhythm, a living confession that God, we trust you to provide and work on our behalf? So ladies, we made it to the top of the hill, the top of the mountain. Congratulations. You guys did awesome. I'm going to pray for us and we will be done. Father, thank you for the book of the covenant. Thank you, God, that this section of scripture that is hard to understand teaches us about your heart. And there are things that we can carry into our lives as we walk out of this room tonight. Your love for the poor, your care for all human life, the zeal you have for your glory, knowing that your worship is the good of your people, and you've commanded us to rest. You've appointed for us a rhythm of life. Thank you for your good provision. Pray now that you would take and seal all that was spoken, that was true according to your word, that you would seal it and protect it and let it bear good fruit according to your will and for your glory. And I pray, God, a blessing over these women. Pray that you would bless them and keep them, make your face to shine upon them, that you would be gracious to them, lift your countenance upon them, and give them your peace as they hope all things in Christ. We love you. We're grateful to be your children. We're grateful for the blood of Christ. It speaks a better word. Yeah, love you. Amen.